From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
Democrats won a big victory in Virginia on Tuesday. What does it mean for 2018? Alabama Republican Senate nominee Roy Moore stands accused of fondling a 14-year-old. Will Republicans stand by him anyway? And as Congress nears a December 8 government shutdown deadline, what can we expect on taxes, immigration, and everything else? You're about to hear a special edition of Left, Right, and Center, taped in front of a live audience at the beautiful theater at the Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles on Thursday, November 9. I'm Josh Barrow, bringing you your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. In this week's show, pollsters Kristen Soltis Anderson and Margie O'Meara joined me to discuss whether we can trust the polls anymore and what the surge in women candidates means for Democrats. And our panel looked back and forward. Has Trump delivered what his supporters hoped and his opponents feared? And can we see the future any more clearly than we did last October? It's all coming up on a very special Left, Right, and Center. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center Live. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor at Business Insider. Up first on tonight's show are two of our favorite experts, the pollsters. On the left is Democratic pollster Margie O'Meara. She is a partner at GBA Strategies. And on the right is Kristen Soltis Anderson. She is a columnist for the Washington Examiner and co-founder of Echelon Insights. Welcome to both of you. Democrats won really big in Virginia on Tuesday, actually way bigger than the polls said they would win. At the end of the governor's race there, the Real Clear Politics average of all the polls had Democratic candidate Ralph Northam ahead by 3.3 points, and then he went on to win by 9. So people don't notice the polling errors as much when the polls are still right about who wins, but this is a big miss, like 5.5 points. It's bigger than a lot of the poll misses that misled us about what would happen in the 2016 election. Is polling still broken? Why was this so far off?
Well, so in fact, Real Clear Politics had a story saying the polls in Virginia look like they are within the Margie margin. That's me. Because you have pollsters may approach, that's the difference between how different pollsters may approach the same data set. So just because you have unweighted data, you have your poll, you've conducted your poll, doesn't mean the answer is 42. The answer is plus 3.3, and that's the only answer. There are different approaches. What are your assumptions about party? What are your assumptions about race? What are your assumptions about turnout? And they are all defensible in advance of election day, because people don't know whether or not they're going to vote, especially in a state like Virginia, where you have an odd year election. You don't have that much early voting. You have a little bit. It's not as dominant as it is in places like in the West or like in Oregon or Washington or in California. So it's a little bit different. It's a little bit different than what the final vote was. I don't know if I'd call it a miss.
Well, five and a half is a lot.
I might call it a miss. I think the polls may have caused folks on your side of the aisle more stress than was perhaps needed.
We're just happy to have the win.
You know, I think missing by 5-6 points, that's certainly outside the statistical margin of error. It's not outside the Margie margin. And I think a lot of folks think of polls as this perfect, exact science. And what a lot of folks don't realize is that polling, I think, is as much an art as it is a science, that there's a lot of human judgment that goes into it. And so we place tons of faith in the idea that if a poll says it's going to be Northam by 3, then it'll be Northam by 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, but anything outside of that would be crazy. And the reality is that for most of these polls, we as pollsters are making judgments about who's going to vote and who's not going to vote. And there's lots of good ways to do that. You look at who voted in the past, you look at who's enthusiastic. But ultimately, we as pollsters are making judgments, and that is science and art at the same time.
Okay, but if you say it's art, I mean, if you have an artwork, different people can look at it and get different things out of it, and you can say you think it represents one thing, and someone else can say it represents a different thing, and that's fine, it works for everyone, but there is a fact of the matter about public opinion, about who's going to vote in an election, how they're going to vote. And so if the polls are, you know, if they're going to be this far off and you say, well, you know, it's art and, you know, we have to look at it, and there are all sorts of different ways you can look at it, does that mean, for example, if we look at the national polls that have Donald Trump's approval rating somewhere in the mid-high 30s, that maybe that's off 5 or 6 points in either direction? Because if Donald Trump is actually approved of by 41% of the country, that tells a very different story than if he's approved of by 28%.
So I think, you know, here's the mistake that I think many of us collectively made looking at 2016, and we don't want to make the same mistake when we think about this Virginia governor's race, which is we just are looking at the horse race. Is Northam up by 3.3 or 5.2 or something else? Is Donald Trump at 38.8 favorable or 41.3? And the reality is there's so much more in the polling and the internal polls that the campaigns are doing or that people who are not just releasing their polling publicly are doing has so much more beyond that, you know, plus 3.3. And there's no way to look at the Virginia results, all the public polling, I'm sure all the internal polling as well, that doesn't tell the same story, which is people found Trump incredibly unpopular. They found the state to be, you know, doing quite well, not this, you know, sort of this hellscape that Gillespie would paint it out to be. That people didn't really like the way that Gillespie was inflaming racial tensions, even if there were Democrats who are agnostic or ambivalent on Confederate monuments. That doesn't mean that was the driving voting issue for them. And so, you know, same thing with Trump, where you look at his numbers, it's not just about his unpopularity, it's about all the ways he's unpopular, all the folks, even Republicans, who feel he tweets too much, he's reckless, he's, you know, not keeping his promises, and so on. So if you take all that together, the story is far more consistent.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about that, because there was this interesting dynamic for Republicans in this race in Virginia, where you have a president who is unpopular now, nationally, more unpopular in Virginia than he is in the whole country. And you had this Republican candidate, Ed Gillespie, who had been the chairman of the Republican National Committee, kind of Mr. Establishment, a lobbyist. And then he's in this campaign and running partly a very Trumpy campaign with his direct mail, with his ads, focusing on illegal immigration, on Confederate monuments, drawing a lot of criticism from Democrats who were saying that his campaign themes were kind of racist. And yet also trying in the Northern Virginia suburbs to be like, hey, I'm Ed Gillespie, Mr. Establishment, normal Republican who's going to cut your taxes, who isn't weird like that. And Kristen, it clearly didn't work because he didn't come close to winning. What are the lessons here for Republican candidates going into 2018, having to run under a president who is both unpopular and extremely distinctive?
Well, I think there are places where the president is very popular, places like Southwest Virginia, where Ed Gillespie did very well. But it's kind of odd to run a strategy of, I'm going to run closer to a president who did not win the state that I am trying to win. I mean, Ed Gillespie's name has been on a ballot in the state of Virginia before, and he actually did quite well in Northern Virginia, came within a couple of points of being a United States senator. And yet, I think you have to go back to the primary. Ed Gillespie was almost not the Republican nominee for the Virginia gubernatorial race. He almost lost to Corey Stewart, who ran a campaign based almost exclusively on the issue of Confederate monuments.
Corey Stewart, who is from Minnesota and was complaining about Yankees coming around Virginia,
correct,
telling people what to do with their monuments.
So I think there is this sense in the Republican Party that there is this monster under the bed that they had missed in 2016. They missed it throughout the Republican primary for president, and that they're continuing to miss it now, whether it's something like the primary in Alabama that put Roy Moore as the Republican nominee for that seat, that there is this sense of, oh my gosh, we are missing this Trump enthusiasm. And I think from a polling perspective, that's part of why the polls underestimated Northam's support, because now, after that miss in 2016, there's a sense of, are there voters out there who we're missing? Is there this Trump constituency that if we don't speak to them, we're missing out on something? And I think both Gillespie and many of the pollsters overestimated how much that would impact things at the ballot box.
So what does this election tell us about next year? Because I know a lot of Democrats were looking at this with great excitement and saying that, you know, this shows momentum, this shows that maybe Democrats can take back the House. Margie, is this performance good enough? If Democrats did like they did in Virginia, would they take the House of Representatives back next year?
So if you look at the composition of the Virginia electorate, it looks a lot more like 2016 than it does like 2013, the last time there was a gubernatorial race. Not the total number of voters, but the percent of the electorate that was white was identical to what it was in 2016.
Which is unusual. Usually in an off-year election, right, the electorate would be whiter.
Right,
than in a
it'd be whiter. But in fact, it was as white as 2016. It was more Democratic than 2016, more Democratic than 2013, so increasingly Democratic. It was as young, but Northam did better with younger voters than McAuliffe did when he ran for governor in 2013. So it's both the composition and the Democratic performance that was really strong. And not only that, the thing that is really cheering for Democrats on top of that is how Democrats did down ballot. The win of Danica Rome, the transgender candidate. I know. I want to applaud every time Every time, I mean, she's such a badass. Like every time I see a photo of her, I see the results, I get excited. I mean, that is such a cheering thing for Democrats. And one of the first Latina delegates ever elected to the state. I mean, there was a really historic sweep throughout the state and around the country and other local races around the country that I think makes Democrats feel cautiously optimistic about what's next.
So you mentioned a few women candidates, and actually a large majority of the Democrats who took back Republican-held seats in the Virginia state legislature. We don't normally spend a lot of time talking about state legislative elections on left, right, and center, but this was, Republicans had an enormous majority, and pending some recounts, Democrats may actually get 50-50 or even in a long shot control of the Virginia House of Representatives delegates. Most of these new Democrats in the House of Delegates are going to be women, and it's part of this national surge in women Democratic candidates. What do you make of this trend, and what is that going to mean for the Democratic Party?
I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, women make up a majority of the electorate. They make up even larger percentage of Democratic primary voters. There are tens of thousands of women who have signed up to run on the Democratic side. It is a clear reaction to Trump and feeling that women's rights are really at stake. It's not a feeling, it's a fact. And it's finally to see that women's actual demographic power and consumer power and the household power that women have potentially actually being matched in political power is something that would be so incredible. And if we can really move that ball a little bit forward this cycle, it would be incredible.
Where are the Republican women? It feels like we're not seeing this on the Republican side.
I think, you know, there are some efforts on the Republican side to try to recruit more women to run for office. But right now, it's just hard to recruit folks to run for office as a Republican generally. We're seeing a lot of folks retiring on the Republican side in Congress because the idea of going up for re-election is, it just seems daunting. Being in Congress doesn't seem like very much fun anymore. I think, you know, you may have somebody like a Martha McSally who may be running to get a promotion to the U.S. Senate.
Arizona. She's in Arizona, that's right. From the Tucson area. But she's also like, she's one of these people who's kind of taking a flyer on a Senate run because she might lose her House seat if she runs for re-election.
Right. This is a very tough year to recruit people to say, put your name on a ballot and run for Congress. I mean, running for office is already painful enough in America, unfortunately, as it is. The idea that you're going to run and you're going to have to navigate this crazy gauntlet where you have to be close enough to the president to survive a primary, but still try to be far enough away that he's not an anchor around your neck in a general election, especially if your district is somewhere in the suburbs, the types of suburbs like we saw in Virginia that broke very heavily away from the GOP. It is a daunting prospect. And so my hope is that Republicans would be able to get young candidates, more women candidates, to step up and say this is not just the party of old white guys, but it is a very hard task to get people to say, yes, I will take that step in an environment that looks like this.
Well, so here on Left, Right, and Center, we have a segment we call It's Been Busy. The idea is we've all been so busy talking about the latest shocking developments in the news that we often don't get to focus on some of the really important things that have been happening. So I want to ask both Margie and Kristen, is there something that's happened in public opinion this year that's important but we've been too busy to notice? Margie?
So I think a lot of folks have been wanting to see Trump voters regret their choice, right? And there's polling there was some polling out this week, like, do you regret, would you vote a different way? Do you regret? And consistently the answer has been no for Trump voters. They say, no, I don't regret, very few. And so just to give an example, right? So folks here, I'm assuming, have listened to Dirty John, right? So like John is Trump and Deborah is America, right? Like the
voters. Explain what this is for the small fraction of people who aren't familiar with Dirty John.
Dirty John is a LA Times, I think, podcast about a man who's very charismatic and he makes his way into this family and he marries this woman, Deborah, who is just incredibly nice and open-minded and wants to give him the benefit of the doubt, even though it's increasingly clear that John is not well. And as you're listening to the podcast, you're like, wait, Deborah, no, why? You have, you know, can't you see? But it just takes her a while. She will get there. And I think for folks who want to see voters immediately regret their vote for Trump, it's just we have to be mindful of their process and open-minded of how they got there and what they're going to think about.
Well, and to cue off of that, you know, we did some survey work with SurveyMonkey, where it asked a bunch of voters what they remember about election night from a year ago. And when you ask voters, how surprised were you about the result? About 3 out of 4 Clinton voters say they were extremely or very surprised. Only about 1 out of 4 Trump voters will confess to being very or extremely surprised. But when you ask them, well, what words would you use to describe how you felt? It's words like relieved, excited. And I think that has some longevity to it. When you're relieved and excited about something, you're not immediately going to abandon someone just because they didn't pass a particular bill or the wall hasn't been built yet.
Well, I mean, it's been a year. I mean, a presidential term is only 4 years. So, like, when are you expecting this wave of regret? I'll put it in my calendar.
We're just going to have to let... Deborah's going to have her own process, okay? We just have to be open-minded. And not judge her.
Well, on that note, I want to thank Democratic pollster Margie O'Meara and Republican pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to a special live Left, Right, and Center. Steve Chiotakis, can you tell us what we're missing on the 405 right now?
Well, because we are actually live on the radio on KCRW. Tell everybody that you love them on the radio. We have actually, Josh, been digging deep into our traffic report right now, and I actually have some information coming up. This is hot off the wire. Thank you so much, Melanie. We appreciate that. We have a SIG alert on the southbound 405. I know this will surprise you, Josh. You live in New York, though. So
I'm aware of the traffic in Los Angeles.
Yeah, yes, you are.
I've seen the Californians on SNL.
This is truthful, by the way. We're not being funny about this, right? Uh-huh. The southbound 405, there's a SIG alert at Avalon. There's a big rig on its side. The off-ramp is shut down, so be aware of that. The eastbound 10 freeway, I feel like Kayshawn Cermak right now. The eastbound 10 freeway at Vermont, the three-vehicle collision stuck in the center divider with people standing on that side of the road. So you want to be aware of that. Our weather forecast, I love doing this part. Mostly cloudy overnight tonight, maybe some clouds near the coast. Overnight lows, upper 50s, low 60s. Tomorrow, this is our weather forecast. This is LA, right? This is why we live here. Clouds yield to sunshine tomorrow. Daytime highs, upper 60s, low 70s. It's not like that in New York, Josh.
Yes, yes.
And average temperatures for the next 5 to 7 days, so that's nice. Okay. And now, as our panelists get ready to head onto the stage, an LRC trivia question for you. Thank you. Which popular game show recently featured LRC as a question to one of its answers? Anybody? Which game show? Wheel of Fortune? No. The Price is Right? No. Oh, come on, I hear you, for God's sakes. Of course, it's Jeopardy. Let's listen.
Hosted by Josh Barrow and Rich Lowry, this political podcast from Public Radio comes at you from all directions. Left, right, and center.
Alex Trebek.
I'm glad we cut out the sound effect indicating that nobody even tried to answer the question.
Did you like that?
Yeah. That was flattering. Yeah.
I'm no dummy, Josh, but thank you. Yeah. Everybody, Josh Barrow, left, right, and center. Oh, what a year!
Thank you, Steve Chiotakis. We are back again with a special live recording of Left, Right, and Center from the theater at the Ace Hotel. I'm Josh Barrow, and we're now joined by our panelists. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Gene Sperling, who directed the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama. And we have two special guests tonight. Mickey Kaus, longtime political blogger at KausFiles.com. And Kelly Goff, who is a columnist for The Daily Beast. Kelly won the applause contest there. It's nice to see all of you in person. So I guess we have to start with Roy Moore. A story in the Washington Post includes accusations from 4 women against Roy Moore. One says that Moore sexually abused her when she was 14 and he was 32, undressing her and placing her hand on his genitals over his underwear. 3 other women say he pursued them romantically when they were aged between 16 and 18 and he was in his early 30s, although in their cases they say nothing went past kissing.
Republicans in the Senate have been saying Moore should step aside if the allegations are true, although John McCain was not so equivocal, simply stating that he ought to withdraw. But Moore has been defiant, saying the story is a fake news fabrication, and his supporters in Alabama seem to be standing by him, as is Sean Hannity. Rich, I feel like I've been hearing this sort of gross argument in the alternative from Moore's defenders saying the stories are false, and if they're true, they're not so bad. The state auditor of Alabama, who's a supporter of Moore's, pointed out that Mary was a teenager when she married Joseph. What does it mean to be a values voter at this point if social conservatives are going to stick with this guy?
Good question. First of all, let me say, this is an amazing turnout and just a testament to the devotion people have, rightly, to this program. And I think, you may not admit it, but you may be with the left, you may be with the center, but I know in your heart you listen because of the right on this show. So look, I have to say the story, a couple of these girls. Well, one, it can't be, none of this can be independently confirmed at this point. And a couple of these girls, what he did with them was bizarre and wrong, but he was dating them with the permission of their mothers. The disturbing story is the 14-year-old, and it seems credible. You know, to the extent it can be confirmed, the Post confirmed it. She told two people at the time she was dating an older man. And
one of them she specifically named Moore. The other only knew that she was dating an older man.
Right. Yeah. And the Moore came up to this child and her mother when they were outside the courthouse for a divorce proceeding. And the Post confirmed that the mother was indeed there for a divorce hearing.
And he was an assistant district attorney.
Right.
But that's the even grosser part.
It's appalling. There's no way to get around it. There are a couple images in this story that if you read it will be indelible in your mind. Because I'm like this audience so much, I'm not going to mention one of them, but I'll mention the other, which one of these girls he met at a mall when she was dressed as an elf as Santa's helper when she was 14 years old. And I think what's happened is partisanship is so strong, and evangelicals and Christian conservatives are now the very most Republican part of the Republican Party. It twists it so the people who should have the highest moral standards when it comes to this sort of thing actually have the lowest.
Mickey, can a vote for Moore be defended at this point?
I know I told you backstage that it could be defended, but I've changed my mind. Moore has, and here's why, Moore has served his purpose. His purpose was to terrify establishment Republicans that if there's an insurgent running against you, all of Mitch McConnell's money and all the lobbyists' money and all this clever strategists aren't going to save you. He's made that point. Now he's actually not that important. They can substitute somebody else who might have a better chance of winning.
Well, but he would have to voluntarily withdraw. If he doesn't withdraw, the choice will be to vote for him or to elect a Democrat.
Or to do a write-in, which is very hard to do.
Right. I think in all likelihood, if he doesn't withdraw from the race, then either he will win or Doug Jones, the Democrat, will win.
Well, if I would vote for Doug Jones or abstain if I thought the 14-year-old story was true.
And do you think it's true?
Do I think it's true?
Yeah.
If I had to guess, I would say yes, but it's a 55-45 proposition as far as I'm concerned.
Kelly, what have you made of the story?
Well, I'll start by saying it's just I got nervous, Rich, and then you brought it back home at the end. I was a little nervous at the beginning, because I do think it's important to say that Roman Polanski's confirmed victim, since he admitted to child rape, was actually brought to his home by her mother. So just because parents make poor choices doesn't mean that any child deserves to be victimized, and I just want to be very clear about that. But I kind of have two feelings about this. The first is, you know, it's hard to believe that just a couple weeks ago when Weinstein started, how outraged and shocked and flabbergasted we were. And literally just back in the green room, someone dropped by and mentioned yet another one that had broken since we had arrived at the theater of someone else who's high profile, who's also been accused. And so I do have the concern that we're going to be so inundated that it's going to kind of become like violence or shootings, where we're concerned for 2 days and then we forget about it. We become kind of immune to it and inoculated from it. I hope that doesn't happen, because there's too much at stake to be done. But I think when we hear these stories, there are kind of three questions that we as good citizens and as voters have to ask ourselves. Are the allegations, are we talking about something that is unethical, something that is hypocritical, or something that is illegal? And then kind of make your determination from there. A candidate having an affair on their, you know, on their spouse, that could be something we consider unethical. But it becomes hypocritical if that person has been campaigning on family values. Someone having an inappropriate relationship with a 14-year-old cruises through all three categories. And there is no way to defend that type of behavior regardless of your party affiliation.
Gene, there's been this big polling shift where, and Rich mentioned the shift in public opinion, the Public Religion Research Institute asks this question about basically, can an elected official who commits an immoral act in their personal life still behave ethically and fulfill their duties in public and professional life? When they asked that in 2011, 30% of white evangelicals said yes. When they asked in 2016, in the midst of the Trump era, 72% said yes. But I feel like the separation from the personal from the political is something that we heard a lot from Democrats during the Clinton administration. And obviously, there wasn't an accusation like this involving a minor with Bill Clinton, but there was, you know, behavior that he did with his subordinate at the White House, an intern, that when we look in what we're discussing right now with workplace behavior and sexual harassment, it would certainly be unacceptable for someone as powerful as the president to carry on a relationship like that. Do we need to make that separation, and in retrospect, were we wrong, or do we need to not make that separation? Were we wrong in retrospect to make it with regard to Bill Clinton?
Well, I think it goes to, you know, what Kelly is saying. There are things that are unethical, immoral, which you have to kind of consider, and then there are things that are just illegal. When a 32-year-old has sex with a 14-year-old, there's actually a name for that. It's called rape. And so I think when you are looking at the moral and ethical, I think that a lot of people probably judge people who are in power or celebrities like they judge their friends, not by their best moment or their worst moment, but by the cumulative of their actions. One of the things that's been striking about some of the men that have come out is that it's been so horrible. There hasn't been that ability to kind of weigh or balance. They've been actual acts of assault, physical assault, illegal. I think when you cross the line like that, that is something. And I think the other, you have to make a judgment. I mean, I obviously worked for President Clinton, and I think, you know, very well of him as a whole and what he's done for his life. But it was wrong. He deserved to, you know, face punishment and condemnation. I think the public all thought impeachment was too much. But I don't think any of us in the White House were defending his actions or didn't think that was something that was fair for people to consider as a serious negative mark on his overall. People look at particulars, obviously, and there were specifics about that. But still, you know, as we look at power relations, and you know, it was the wrong thing for him to do.
So I think, you know, the crude political reason that so many Republicans are sticking with Moore here is that they feel that they need his vote in the Senate, and they don't want another Democratic vote there, which would take the Republican majority down to just a very slim 51. And it's gotten me thinking about this question, you know, what are Republicans getting out of their full control of the federal government? They won what they were working on for so many years to control these levers of government, and it's not clear to me how much they're actually doing with it. So I want to ask all of you, and I want to start with Mickey, who was the most enthusiastic about Donald Trump a year ago. Has what a Republican government in Washington led by Donald Trump, has it delivered what you were hoping for and what some of you were hoping and fearing of here on the panel?
It's certainly not delivered what I was hoping for. He's decided to waste the first year of his presidency not pursuing his agenda, but pursuing Paul Ryan's agenda, and then not even achieving it. So he didn't do the Obamacare repeal and replace. I'm not at all confident this tax bill will pass. Instead of doing the things that, you know, trade, immigration, infrastructure, that were the core of his appeal, his unique appeal. So I'm very disappointed in that. That said, he has achieved huge changes in regulations, for good or ill, and he is already, just by letting the Border Patrol do its work, caused a 41% drop. It goes up and down. Drop in people trying to cross the border illegally. Now that's creeping back up, so he has to do something else. But he's on the verge of actually maybe achieving some actual concrete reforms in immigration. So it's about what I expected. He's not going to change. He's not the grand man with a plan that I'd hoped. But he has made some progress.
How about Gene? Has he realized your fears?
You know, yes. I had, you know, perhaps because I'm just an eternal optimist, there was a moment when he was meeting with President Obama where I thought perhaps the show would be over and we would see some reining back. But, you know, as much as I spend my life fighting to protect Obamacare, which he himself decided to accelerate and do the first thing. And by the way, probably nothing has helped him more than it didn't pass, because had it passed, the harm it would have done to his own voters on Medicaid and nursing homes with disabilities would have, I think, been the substantively negative thing that would have turned people against him. But I think that what has been most depressing, Rich, what's been worse than my fears is, excuse me, Josh, is that...
You can talk to Rich.
To Rich and Josh. I think what's been the worst is that somebody in our country, Democrat or Republican, could so attack our basic trust in the rule of law. And everybody in this panel and on the audience knows the following. Had a Democrat done something like refuse to divest, become a walking conflict of interest, ask the FBI director to prosecute their enemies and let off their friends, fire the FBI director as a form of obstruction of justice, threaten the media, even in antitrust cases. I mean, what do you think the Republican reaction would be? Now, I was in the White House, and you know, when Paul Ryan and others would complain to me about President Obama, it was usually they were upset with his tone of his voice. No, I mean it. They thought he occasionally had an arrogant tone when he was talking to them. This is a fundamental threat to the rule of law in our country, and I would have expected that many of the Republicans that I worked with, who I thought were fundamentally decent people, would stand up and not just be two or three. And that is going to fundamentally determine how our democracy survives. Not what Donald Trump does. We know who he is. It's whether honorable Republicans will stand up for the rule of law that has kept our country afloat for over 200 years.
So, much of what Gene was saying there, especially the rule of law part, sounds a lot like what we hear from David Frum, one of our frequent panelists on this show, who is a conservative, but has been sort of hair on fire alarmed about Donald Trump and institutions. And Rich, do you...
I think a couple weeks ago, his hair actually exploded in my hair, if I'm not mistaken.
Fortunately, he was in a studio in Washington. We were in New York, so we didn't get singed by that. But Rich, I mean, do you take this criticism seriously? I mean, we've had an interesting story this week with this proposed merger between AT&T and Time Warner. And there have been a number of news stories that say different things about one in the Financial Times had sources saying that, you know, the Justice Department is raising objections and it's all about CNN, that they want them to sell off CNN, and it's tied to Trump's complaints about CNN's coverage. And then you see other reporting elsewhere saying, no, it's about that they want them to sell off either DirecTV or the whole Turner Broadcasting Network. And the thing is, there's a policy case to be made about why there might be an antitrust violation in this merger, but nobody trusts this White House. Mm-hmm. When they say, no, this is really about a policy issue, this isn't about the president's vendetta against CNN. So isn't that, you know, regardless of the right, you know, antitrust policy there, isn't this a huge problem that the trust destruction, that when the government acts, people can't trust because it's Donald Trump, that it's acting in an honest and forthright way?
Yeah, no, it is a problem. I don't know what specifically to make of the controversy over this merger, because there are two different accounts what was said in the meeting, and I think facts matter, and we need to know what the facts are. The reason I am less alarmed than David Frum and then Gene is is, look, Trump obviously isn't a rigorous constitutionalist, right? He's appointing a lot of constitutionalist judges, but that's because he's outsourced that to the Federal Society, people who know and care about the Constitution and are giving him constitutionalist judges to appoint. But I also don't think he's ripping up our constitutional order. And most of his offenses go to what you're discussing, Justice, things that he's saying, which are disturbing, are wrong, that he shouldn't say, but that aren't tantamount to acts. And I think my colleague Yuval Levin has a piece in the next issue of National Review that I think is very acute about Trump. Not a constitutionalist, not an anti-constitutionalist. He has an a-constitutional conception of American government and the role of the presidency. It just doesn't enter into his mind. And he thinks of the presidency as being a platform for his celebrity and for him to get attention. And this is a conception of the presidency that would have blown the minds of the founder. It wouldn't even occur to our founding fathers. And, you know, a lot of the things he does, a friend of his was telling me a couple weeks ago, you have to understand every day that Donald Trump wakes up, he just doesn't want to be bored. So, you know, he blows something up, and we're like, how could he be doing this? It's self-defeating. It's terrible for the country. It's entertaining for him. You know, he likes watching on TV and see everyone mystified by what he's doing, or at least discussing what he's doing. And that's really not what the presidency is for.
Is aconstitutional really any better than anti-constitutional? Like, Republicans have talked for decades about, like, the importance of the Constitution and restoring the bounds of the Constitution on federal power. And if Trump just thinks that's all unimportant, who cares, that seems pretty bad,
yeah,
right?
No.
Isn't that norm-breaking in a bad way?
Constitutionalist would be better.
Kelly, how has Trump met with your hopes and fears?
Well, first of all, I think the verdict is still out on whether or not being a-constitutional or a strict constitutionalist or anti-constitutional is worse, because I don't think the man's read the Constitution. And I'm not saying that to be mean. I genuinely don't think he's read it. I don't think he has any interest in reading
long.
It. It's really long.
Document.
No, exactly. Right?
He cares particularly about Article 12.
Right? And unlike the rest of us, he didn't have to actually worry about working his way through college and that sort of thing because, you know, he came from a family that could get him in and that sort of thing. So he, you know, reading the Constitution is for us dummies, I think is kind of how he sees it.
But so how is this year gone compared to what you expected? Is it better or worse?
Well, unlike some people, I actually think he's accomplished quite a bit. I think none of it has to do with policy. But I think that he has, I mean, I will agree with what Mickey said, that if you look at the sheer numbers, you know, he hasn't gotten his wall. He'll probably never get his wall. He hasn't gotten any immigration reform through. That sounds like he's accomplished nothing on immigration, except that the Department of Homeland Security and Border Patrol will tell you that illegal immigration is down by between 50 and 75%, depending on what your source is. So just by bluster, he has actually accomplished quite a bit on this issue. And you see among the people who were polled about him, about his, you know, immigration issues a year ago and voted for him till now, they feel he's accomplished quite a bit. But his other accomplishments, as far as I see them, you know, are really things like increasing the divisive rhetoric in our country. I think he's been great at doing that. But I also think he's accomplished a couple of other things. Namely, he managed to turn apathetic voters into voters who really care. And we saw that this week. And I think it was very clear a year ago that there were a lot of, in particular, Obama voters, and I would say independent voters, who kind of shrugged because it could never happen. He could never win. So I'm going to vote for Stein. I'm going to vote for Johnson. And in states in particular like Florida and Michigan, you know, where Hillary Clinton lost one state by like 12,000 votes and then third-party candidates got over 100,000 votes, I think a lot of those voters showed up in some of the local races this week. And I don't think that would have happened had it not been for Donald Trump. The other thing I would say is, you know, seeing people like former President George W. Bush and Mitt Romney become voices of diversity, I don't think that happens without Donald Trump becoming president. So I think he's accomplished quite a bit.
But he's reduced apathy on both sides. I mean, a key to his victory in 2016 was turnout levels among non-college educated whites, especially in the Midwest, that were unseen. People who had decided that it was pointless to vote in election after election turned out and voted for him. And they, we'll talk a little bit later about how some of those people feel today, but it seems like that he had activated some of them. Mickey, do you have a quick comment before?
If you read The New Yorker, we thought Trump was going to be Hitler or something like Hitler. He's not even Nixon. He aspires to Nixon. Nixon finagled with the antitrust laws to punish his enemies, but he didn't talk about it in public. Trump talks about it in public, which means it's very unlikely that he's going to get away with it because every judge in the country is going to be set against him.
Nikki, I'm going to throw out an idea here. I think people who are not straight white males might disagree with you that he's not as dangerous as he sounded.
I want to stand up for David Frum. I don't think it's pulling your hair out or your hair on fire to be concerned about the basic rule of law. I mean, you know, we talk about it as if, like, we were talking about what your view on constitutional interpretation is. Whether the executive power can run rampant over the rule of law is what separates authoritarian and dictatorships from democracy. It's at the very core. So, you know, praise, you know, I'm not one who criticizes the Jeff Flakes because they don't do enough. It is important for the Frums and the Flakes and the other people to stand up and say, this is what our country is about. Yes, when you're a Democrat or Republican, you make little bits of excuse for your side. We're all a little bit like that. But you think there's a basic core. And just bluster, he fired the FBI director because he was investigating him. He asked the FBI director to drop a investigation against one of his cronies, who we now know and will see more, has significant illegal behavior. If that is not a threat to your basic constitutional rule of law, I don't know what it is. So let's not well, put a bad name for people who are, their hair is on fire. They're just being basic and decent and principled.
The rap on Trump was that he wouldn't obey the courts. If the courts told him to do something, he was going to go, you know, not respect the law. The courts have ruled against him. He's obeyed every decision. He has obeyed the rule of law. If the courts rule against him on Comey, I expect him to obey that. Thomas Jefferson personally supervised the prosecution of Aaron Burr. So we can get carried away about executives interfering in decisions where they, you know, he had a right to fire Comey, and a lot of Democrats would have fired Comey.
I mean, there are all sorts of things that are legal unless you're doing them to obstruct justice, in which case they're not legal. But I come down somewhere in between these two, which is that I think he is trying to use the executive power to undermine the rule of law. He's just often not very good at it. He fired Comey, and not only did that not get rid of the investigation that he hated, it accelerated it. It led to the appointment of a special prosecutor. He hasn't fired the special prosecutor, not because he, like, suddenly developed a respect for the importance of independent prosecutions, but because he realized that firing the special prosecutor wouldn't end the investigation. It would only make it worse. So I think, you know, I think the talk can be damaging, and I think that he's not above trying to undermine the rule of law, but the problem is the government is big and complicated, and he doesn't have a lot of allies, and he doesn't have a lot of allies who know how the government works. And so I think he is thwarted by the institutions that we have that are holding up better than I predicted. So I think, you know, Donald Trump's intentions have been no better than I expected them to be a year ago, but I have been pleased that his effectiveness has been lower than it might have been. This is Left, Right, and Center. This is Left, Right, and Center coming to you live, recording at the theater at the Ace Hotel on Thursday, November 9th, almost 1 year exactly to the day after the election of Donald Trump. I am talking with Rich Lowry of National Review, Gene Sperling, a veteran of the Clinton and Obama administrations, Kelly Goff of the Daily Beast, and Mickey Kaus of KausFiles.com. So I want to turn and look toward the future. It's been an eventful year, and we're about to embark on what I think is going to be an especially eventful month in the eventful year. The deal that was struck to keep the government open in September will run out on December 8th. To keep it open longer, there will have to be a bipartisan agreement on government spending priorities, and probably also on some other issues. Democrats want the deal to include a legislative fix for the DACA program. That's the program that protects unauthorized immigrants who arrived in the United States as children from being deported. Funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program has run out, and states will have to start limiting enrollment if that funding is not reauthorized. There's still talk about doing something about bump stocks, but that hasn't moved very much. And there's this tax bill, which Republicans keep saying that they hope to get done by the end of the year, although I'm a little skeptical that they will do that. Rich, when we're looking back on December 31st, what do you think is going to have happened between now and then, and what will be the consequences of the things that Trump and the Congress are not able to bring themselves to do over that period?
Well, the big question is the tax bill. And this is one reason Republicans need to win Alabama. If they lose that seat and just have 51 votes in the Senate, I think it'd be catastrophic for the tax bill. And I don't think they're going to get a lot of political benefit if they pass the tax bill. It's the best polling shows it marginally. The best polling for the bill, I should say, not necessarily on the merits, but the best polling shows it marginally popular, and then there's polling that shows it fairly unpopular, but not catastrophically unpopular, like the health bill, so that's a good thing. But what they'll forestall is if they don't get it, their donors quitting on them and a lot of their voters quitting on them and thinking they deserve to lose because they are gifted this incredible thing that no one expected, unified control of the federal government, and they would have had a legislative goose egg the first year if they don't get the tax bill. So that's a very big, the most important question, I think, legislatively. On DACA, I think there's either going to be a deal where restrictionists like myself don't get much to show for it, because I think a lot of Republicans think this is a political loser, and a lot of them, like McConnell and Ryan, would just be happy to sign on to a codification of DACA without really getting anything much for it. And I think maybe that's even where Donald Trump's heart is. So I don't think Republicans have a lot of leverage, and I think Democrats are aware of that, so that will tell in the deal. And in terms of government funding and the rest of it, I think it'll probably just be, you know, a patch where it's kind of status quo.
So you think there won't be a shutdown? You think they'll get something done?
I doubt there'll be a shutdown.
Kelly, you were...
I don't know. He has a heart.
Well, he has preferences. He has... He has urges.
Okay. okay. Yeah. Look, all of the polling has been pretty consistent, actually. It hasn't fluctuated that much over the last decade on this issue. And I've spoken about this on air more than once.
I'm sorry, this is immigration?
I'm talking specifically about immigration, which is the majority of Americans, even when you look across partisan lines, support Dreamers staying here. A majority of Americans, give or take a couple points depending on which state you're in, also believe that people who were adults when they came, the government should have a right to deport them. And I have said all along that I think that Democrats and progressives made a mistake by standing firm on saying, no, any adult, no matter what their age, who comes here should have a right to stay, particularly if they've had children here, because I think that's part of what gave Trump momentum to win, because they looked like they were not willing to compromise, they looked like they were not being reasonable. And then also, I've said this before, if you use the word racist too much, it takes sting and power out of it. Calling people racist who say that I think an adult who comes here should be deported became a problem. And so I think that we're at the same place we were 10 years ago, which is essentially people want Dreamers to be able to stay. And I think any Republican-backed bill that tries to get rid of Dreamers is going to die.
So, but the interesting thing here is that what you're describing, it's true that Democrats have moved quite far to the left on immigration over the last 8 years. If you tried to take Obama's position where he, you know, actually would brag about the immigration enforcement numbers and how deportations had gone up, at least by the measures that they used,
right,
you wouldn't be able to do that in Democratic primary now. And part of
and then he introduced restrictions to make sure that the parents of Dreamers could stay as well.
Right.
Go ahead. Yeah.
But so this was basically Ed Gillespie's theory in the governor's race, was he leaned really heavily on immigration in the campaign, thought that Democrats had gotten really far out to the left, were too tied to ideas like sanctuary cities that would be unpopular. He hit Northam over the head over and over on this.
Mexican gangs will be everywhere.
Right.
Everywhere.
And then he lost badly. Yeah. He lost by 9 points. And so, Gene, do you buy this idea that Kelly's putting out that Democrats got too far out to the left on immigration? Because it doesn't seem that they were punished, at least in Virginia, for the immigration position.
Look, I think most Americans, you know, I mean, what I think is unfortunate to me is not the immigration, but it is the effort. When people are unhappy, some people have a skill, some great political leaders have a skill of taking that unhappiness and using it to mobilize positive efforts to jobs, to skills, to education. And we've known that in our country and other countries around the world, some people have a great skill of taking that unhappiness and then dividing people and finding an enemy in fear. And I find what has been so distressing with President Trump, with Latinos, with people who are Muslims, is trying to create that, direct their legitimate anger towards people who are without power, unpopular, and I think it's wrong morally, and I think people also are not as simple-minded on it. Yes, they want border security. Contrary to what you're hearing here, the number of illegal undocumented immigrants was about 12.2 million in 2007. It was already going down. It was already down a million. This idea that this was like a sudden problem, this was more the politics of resentment and fear. So I do think Democrats should make sure that they respect the rule of law, border security, but I don't think Americans like seeing these stories of children ripped from their parents. I think they also have values of family. I think they have values that they see in the Dreamers, people who are completing, going to college, graduating from high school, who want to stay here, who love America. So I think, yes, you have to be careful not to go too far. But I don't really think that this is the fundamental problem. And I think in the long run, those who support a measured move towards citizenship will be doing the right thing for their country. They'll be doing the right thing morally. And I think in the long term, it will be the right thing politically.
Can I just clarify, though, because you're absolutely right on the numbers, Gene, but specifically what Border Patrol is talking about is not the number of illegal immigrants coming to the country, but people who were not even trying. And they're able to measure that by things like going to the actual shelters that migrants stay in that protect them, right? And so there are priests who are saying, we used to have 100 people a night, now we're down to 15 people, 20 people a night. So the number of people who aren't even trying has decreased significantly since Trump took office. But the other thing I would say, too, is I just want to clarify, I think part of why Gillespie lost in Virginia was because in the same way you can have extremists on the left, there's also being extreme on the right. And his ads were relying on perpetuating this idea that every Mexican person is a gang member. Who buys that? I mean, that is the even further right version of taco trucks on every corner. I mean, that is so offensive, I think, to people that how could you not vote for the other candidate is, I think, part of how that played out.
Mickey?
To my mind, the biggest problem with the country is that it's very hard to make a dignified living as an unskilled worker. There are three forces driving that down. Trade, the trade deals of the past couple of decades, technology, automation, and immigration. Okay, Trump at least tried to tackle two of those three, trade and immigration. It's not divisive to try to control the forces that are driving down wages of unskilled people. So I don't agree that it was a racist, divisive thing to do. And he might actually make some progress. What he wants in exchange for protecting the Dreamers is an end to chain migration, which would be a big deal in terms of cutting down the total numbers of immigrants, but would not deport anybody who's actually here.
But the thing is, isn't it like, I realize that a more restrictive immigration policy could, in theory, not be divisive, but it seems like we've gotten the worst of both worlds out of Donald Trump, which is that he's had all sorts of extremely divisive rhetoric, starting from the very first speech of his campaign, where he said, you know, they're not sending their best, they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. And then, while I think it's true that his rhetoric has had some effect on how many people are trying to enter the U.S. without authorization, he's had no coherent legislative strategy on this. As you note, he's put much more emphasis on the things that Paul Ryan wanted to do. They didn't have a good legislative strategy, but they had a legislative strategy on healthcare and on tax. And it seems to me that Trump has achieved the social division and has achieved the sort of the nastiness without having anything that looks like he's going to achieve something lasting on policy.
The problem is he doesn't understand his own immigration agenda. I mean, he knows he opposes illegal immigration. And then there are people around him who have thought about this, you know, for 10 years very closely, how you reform the legal immigration system, including reducing numbers. And this happened constantly during the debates, where they put out a white paper written by Stephen Miller that was very coherent, restrictionist agenda, and then Trump would go on a stage and say, we need more legal immigrant visas. And then Stephen Miller's hair would go on fire, you know, back in the green room, and they'd have to put out a statement the next day, no, that's not what he meant. He meant something else. I have to say, one of the worst lessons that Democrats can learn from Virginia if they want to defeat Trump in 2020 is that extremism on immigration works for their side. And sanctuary cities, make no mistake, that's an extreme policy. Now it's a very fuzzy concept, but if you get to the root of it, what it means, your locality, you jail an illegal immigrant for committing a crime. The federal government comes to you and says, we have information this person is dangerous, please tell us.
when you're going to release them so we can take them into our custody and make sure that this person is deported. And the locality says, no, we don't even want to communicate with you. That is an extreme position. And if Democrats, I've said this, you know, over and over again on the show, I think there's a lot of room for them to go to the left on economics, but they need to give a little. They need to go to the center on some cultural issues, including immigration.
And notably, Ralph Northam, I mean, no city in Virginia has a policy quite like that. And he said, well, if someone wanted to do this and they sent me a bill to prohibit it, I'd sign it, which drew him a lot of fire from the left. I think one of the interesting lessons we learned from Virginia was there was a lot of Democratic infighting. There was a primary that was quite contentious there. There was a left-wing group, Democracy for America, that had been founded years ago by Howard Dean that said that Northam's campaign had been racist because he said this about sanctuary cities and they wouldn't support him. And ultimately, none of that seemed to matter. The Democratic coalition held together fine. And so I think you can have a certain amount of infighting, and it ends up being a thing that you can survive, including if it means that you break with something that's supposed to be a deal-breaker issue
I think it also tells you perhaps that Northam's internal polling showed what you just said, Rich. I don't think it's a coincidence that he flip-flopped on that issue close to the election.
We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. And in honor of our second annual live show at the ACE, let's make predictions instead of doing rants, and let's try to make better predictions than we made in October of last year. Gene
Speak
Sperling.
Speak for yourself.
What's that?
Speak for yourself.
Fair. Gene Sperling, what do you see in the future?
My prediction and rant will merge together. I predict that come November 2018, some of these little sheep, who I guess are called congressional Republicans in California, will pay some price for dramatically voting against the interest of their constituents and their state twice. Once for a health care bill that would have crushed Medicaid funding and coverage in the state, and now again supporting almost en masse a tax cut that is specifically targeted at the state of California politically, and they are all like little sheep supporting it, and they might get away with it in their desperation now, but I don't think they'll get away with it come November 2018.
Oh, Mickey. So there'll be even fewer Republicans in California. That's what you're saying, Gene?
I mean, there's 15 Republicans in the House of Representatives from California,
14.
I think. Yeah.
14, and all 14 voted for the health care bill, and I'm not sure whether one is going to think about voting against the tax bill that's going to raise the California state taxes by 25% to 40% effectively for itemizers.
Mickey Kaus.
I'm going to have a slightly spacey prediction. It seems to me an issue that nobody wants to talk about is the issue of artificial intelligence, robots taking jobs, robots taking everybody's job and fundamentally transforming society. I predict sometime in the next 5 years, somebody will promote the Amish solution, which is just make it illegal. When we don't like things and we don't have a solution for them, the answer is prohibit them. That might not be the right solution, but I think a lot of people are going to find it an appealing solution. You obviously don't ban all AI, but you would have some government board that said, no, you can't do that.
So when sometimes people call Mickey Kaus a Luddite, but it sounds like you're going to like literally be a Luddite in a few years. Smashing the machines to... That's okay. I mean, it takes all kinds.
Whatever you do, please don't mention this idea to President Trump.
Kelly Goff, what's in your crystal ball?
How do I follow that? You know, they called 1992 the year of the woman because a record number of female candidates were elected to Congress and the Senate. I predict that the next round of midterms, thanks to Harvey Weinstein, thanks to Roger Ailes, thanks to Roy Moore, thanks to Donald Trump, we're definitely going to see a year of the woman. I think across party lines, we're going to see a lot of women running and winning.
And Rich Lowry, what do you see in the future?
I have a very broad-gauged prediction. I'm quite confident, and I want to reassure all of you, whatever trend most disturbs you in American public life will get worse.
That leads very well into my prediction, which what I'd written down here was that I think things will keep getting stupider.
But that too.
But not forever. I think there's become this disconnect where people don't really think who wins federal elections has an effect on what the government will do for them. The Democrats, if they implement programs, they won't help very much. And then if Republicans are elected, they won't follow through on their promises to take things away. And to a large extent, that's been borne out since the 2016 election. If you were a lower-income Republican voter who thought that Trump was serious about sticking it to your cultural enemies and wouldn't end up taking away your Obamacare, so far you have been proved right. And state politics isn't really like this. Margie mentioned Danica Rome, this woman who is the first transgender, will be the first transgender person, elected to and seated in a state legislature come January. She defeated a longstanding Republican incumbent, and her signature campaign issue was traffic. She was elected in a middle-ring suburban district outside Washington, D.C., where the traffic is awful, and she has a plan to fund new grade-separated interchanges on Route 28, which is a major expressway through the area. And her opponent was this guy who had been in the legislature for more than 20 years, literally called himself the chief homophobe of the Virginia legislature. His campaign refused to address her as a woman. And while her election was culturally historic, he was the one who seemed obsessed with cultural politics rather than the nuts and bolts business of what state government actually does. And so this is just an example. State elections are about real things that the government does, and I think a candidate who can connect in a real and tangible way about what the federal government can do for people can make federal politics more like that and therefore less stupid. Now, this isn't about laundry lists. The problem with Hillary Clinton's campaign platform was not that it was too short. It's about finding a few tangible policy issues that connect with people nationally in the same way that traffic on Route 28 does in Prince William County. And so that's a real plan to fight the opiate crisis. It's a bigger child tax credit. It's rules against new annoying airline fees. Ideas that people can look at and say, that matters, that would make my life better. And once someone comes along who can do that, I think that's going to do a lot to unstupid our politics. I think it's coming, but I don't think it's coming right away. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Gene Sperling, Kelly Goff, and Mickey Kaus, and I also want to thank the pollsters, Margie Omero and Kristen Soltis Anderson. I want to thank our hosts here at the Theater at the Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. Our live event was produced by Aaron Sine and the KCRW events team. Laura Dimillion produced today's program. Our technical director was Phil Richards. Katie Berskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.